Radio City. After a little bit of a delay, John Grace and Rob Ross back at it and back with you, and at least for the time being, relatively healthy again. Rob Ross, how are you?
I'm okay by and large. I did have an incident where I strained my right arm, which I really didn't need to do because I've had problems of that nature in the past, which sent me to physical therapy. So I've been trying to nurse it back to health over the last 48 hours. But, yeah, none the worse for wear. We obviously both had a bad football week. The Jets lost, the Bills lost. But on the good news front, the New England Patriots lost.
Yes, and which was nice to see. And it was nice to see it happen in the way that it did. Because every time I see Tom Brady get that frustrated look on his face, it makes me a happy boy.
Exactly. And you know, I think we're all in agreement that Tom Brady sucks.
Yeah.
Not that he's not a great player. He just sucks, you know, and I'm sick of seeing his face. I'm sick of watching him play. Dude, walk away from the game.
Yeah.
You're old. It's that simple. You're going to be limping out or be carried out.
Right.
When all is said and done, because they're coming for you now.
And here I am calling Tom Brady old while I'm 8 years older than he is.
And that's what I want to start the show with. A happy birthday tribute to you, sir. Well, yeah, you're still infinitely younger than I am, which makes you just a, you know, another one of those young scalawags and ruffians that I so egregiously wish to beat with a stick. Still, I hope your birthday was fantastic. I hope that you were feeling well on your birthday.
Yeah, not bad, not bad. Much better than I had been for the week previous to it. And yeah, 49 years old now. So on we go to yet another trip around the sun. And it was, you know, what was great is to hear from all of the people that I did and to recognize that at age 49, I'm surrounded by people that I genuinely like, you know? And that's a nice feeling that a lot of the chaff has been sort of excised over the years. And I'm left with a whole bunch of really cool and groovy people around me.
Well, that's always a good thing to hear. And the fact is, you know, it's even nicer that you're quoting from a not great REM album. you know, look, birthdays as we get older are sort of the anticlimax. You know, I used to acknowledge my own birthday when I was younger by not going to school or then not going to work.
Right.
You know, and I never would tell people it's my birthday. I never liked that. That's just me. But I got to a certain point. I don't remember when it was specifically. It may have been my 33rd birthday that I actually went to work simply because I didn't want to be at home with my girlfriend at the time because I couldn't stand her. And I'm saying that in all seriousness. And she turned around and wound up sending flowers to me at work. This was in the days when I worked at Atlantic Records and everyone's like, wait, is today your birthday? I'm like, damn it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want anyone to know. And, you know, the only time that I made any reference to a birthday of, quote, merit was my 50th birthday because, let's face it, 50 is a milestone.
Yep.
And so my acknowledgement of it was I went to work that day, but I did get two VIP tickets, of course, to see The Who at Barclays Center in Brooklyn. You know, and that show was going to be in May. My birthday was in January. And I said, you know, as long as I'm still alive, Pete's still alive, and Roger's still alive, we should be okay.
Yep.
So that's how I celebrated and acknowledged my 50th birthday with The Who. So I could not have asked for better.
Right.
Birthdays are what you want to make of it. You
exactly,
know?
Yeah. And with me, it was rung in. My mom was in town, and it was great to see her because she's had some health issues, too, over the last couple of years that thankfully now look like the light at the end of the tunnel is actually a light and not a gorilla with a flashlight. And so, you know, to have her here and celebrating with us was just wonderful. And now a month from now, we get to go down to Florida and do the same thing with my wife and her family for her 49th.
Now, the question at hand is, when do you begin the plans for the 50th?
Yeah. Believe it or not, yeah, Mom was already all over that while she was here this weekend. So it looks like that may be a trip overseas. So we'll see what happens between now and then.
Yeah, but they'll probably clap you in irons.
I wouldn't doubt it. Either that or they won't let me back in, which is more likely if Donald Trump is still president.
That'll be huge. Huge. But I do want to share one thing with our listening audience that was of a very happy nature since you and I had our last conversation. And that is there's been a new addition to our family.
Good for you.
I very happily, well, Liz and I very happily adopted this beautiful, sweet little black cat named Bailey. And we added Buttercup Bear to her name. So we are the proud parents of this year and 2-month-old girl The story went that she had wandered into the yard of somebody who happened to be, thankfully, a cat lover, and showed herself to be so friendly that they brought her in, they then took her to the doctor, had her fixed, microchipped, and vetted for adoption, and obviously fostered, so that way she would be agreeable with other cats. I had read her story on the Staten Island Council for Animal Welfare site, the same people that we had adopted Roxy and prior to Roxy Midnight from. Read her story, and I just thought she looked so sweet, and it did, there just seemed to be something there about her particular story that touched me enough that I wanted to meet her at the very least. And Liz was against having a third cat because, you know, you want to divide the attention to a 15-year-old and a 6-year-old evenly. The thing is, in the back of my mind, with Paisley now being 15 years old, I don't want Roxy to go through what Paisley went through when Midnight passed, or what our other cat, Nibbles, had gone through when Jinx had passed. You know, and that is the trauma of suddenly being alone and not understanding why. It's impossible to describe what an animal goes through when they lose their lifelong playmate. So, you know, we'd talked about, you know, adopting, and we'd always go and visit the cats at the Psycho shelter at the local PetSmart. And this has been for the last 2 or 3 months, to be honest with you, since our story first appeared. Well, 2 weeks ago, just around the time that you and I had our last conversation, just afterwards, we were at PetSmart and Bailey was actually there. So we got to meet her and they took her out of the cage and I was holding her and she was cuddling and purring. And then Liz held her and was cuddling and purring. And we asked them, do you ever do meet and greets and bring the cat to the home to actually meet the other cats to see if they get along? And they said, sure they do. So we said, we will call you during the week to arrange something while Liz is at home. Well, that was on a Saturday. And Liz calls me at work on Wednesday and says, the people from Psycaw are here. And I should say that one thing that they do from Psycaw is that they actually visit the homes of potential adopters, just like you would if you were a potential adopter for a child, you know, to make sure that it's a safe and healthy atmosphere, in this case, for the animal. I was like, what do you mean they're there? I thought we were arranging a meet and greet. And she said, no, you know, I spoke to them and I just decided we want Bailey. So I've already paid the, the $100 fee for the whole. And she's ours. I'm like, wow. Well, okay, great. Keep me posted. You know, when can we go pick her up? Oh, we'll arrange that. 2 hours later, I get a text and a photo from her. Bailey's in the carrier and they're in a cab on the way home. So by the time I came home, there she was with this sweet little ball of fluff. And in the span of a week and a half, she's already comfortable. She's certainly comfortable with Liz and I. You know, she comes up and lets you hold her, and she coos and purrs and mews, and she is just so sweet and so outwardly affectionate. It's wonderful. And I have to say I'm really happy the fact that even though they're keeping a respectful distance still, there's been no fighting with Paisley or Roxy and Bailey. You know, Bailey's very nice, and she's always watching them, and she keeps a sort of respectful distance. Occasionally, the other two may give a little half-hearted hiss, but they're getting used to one another.
That's setting boundaries. That's all that is everybody setting boundaries and getting, okay, this is yours, this is mine.
Because goodness knows, when we first brought in Roxy, it scared Paisley so much that she wouldn't come out of the bedroom for almost a year.
There you go.
The only thing she would do, and she would just go to the box and that would be it. I would have to bring her food dishes into the bedroom so she would eat. Then out of nowhere, after a year, I was preparing breakfast one morning and there's Paisley in the kitchen with me like nothing had ever happened. So the thing is, as horrible as it sounds, this is also done with Roxy's best interest in mind, because I don't want her alone, God forbid. And Paisley is 15 years old now and she's gotten thinner and older, and so far there are no signs of anything being wrong, save for the part that she's thinner, but she's as kittenish and as bouncy and as energetic as she's ever been. And God knows she's vocal as all get out. So we're back to having three cats after 6 years, because that was the last time we had three, when we had Nibbles, Midnight, and Paisley. And I'm very happy that Bailey joined our family because she's the right fit. So there is some definitely, a silver lining to the ups and downs of the last couple of weeks.
Good for you. That's excellent. And there have certainly been plenty of ups and downs, as you said, for both of us. But, now it's time for me to go off on my family just a little bit. As much as I said, it was wonderful to have Mom here for the birthday weekend, and it was, and I think she had a great time as well. The one thing that threw a little bit of a damper on it was family elsewhere in the country. And to give some background on this, when I was a kid, we had cousins. It was my mom's older sister's children who were about the same age as me and my sister. My sister's 5 years older than me. So they had a girl who was 5 years older than their son. So it was Colleen and Aaron and my sister Beth and me. And Colleen and Beth were about the same age, and Aaron and I are about the same age. So we used to do these family Thanksgivings at one house or the other. So they'd come over to our house 1 year, and we'd go to Gloversville, New York, and go to their house, the opposite years. And so we kind of grew up together, but as cousins do, you sort of grow apart over time, and you just sort of keep track of each other. Well, as we're recording this, Hurricane Florence still continues to dump all kinds of rain and wind and devastation. And right now they're looking at the levees in North Carolina, wondering if everything is going to hold up and if they're going to have to do any more water rescues than they already have. And they're to the point in the storm now where they're going for all of the people who said, I'm going to stay here and ride this thing out, who now thought better of it and said, well, maybe that was a pretty stupid thing to do, like everyone had been telling us for a week. Well, one of those people is my cousin Colleen, who has, in Wilmington, North Carolina, of all places, where she's lived for the last 20 years, decided that she just couldn't leave her dogs behind and decided to ride out the storm, apparently unaware that there are, in fact, hotels that allow dogs. So, what I don't think occurs to people in a time like this, and far be it for me to torpedo my own cousin, but I don't think they realize sometimes what a selfish bullshit thing that is to do. Because now, for the last day and a half, she's had no contact with the outside world. We don't know if she's alive or dead. We got a couple of texts from her in the height of the storm saying the power is out, but we're still here and we're okay. But that's the last anybody heard from her, and that's now going on 36 hours ago. And I'm sure everything's okay. We'll have an update on that next week, I guess. But still, for her mom and the rest of the family who are all sitting here, and we're talking about an Irish Catholic family that's 8 kids strong, and everybody's wondering, is everything okay in North Carolina? And there's no way to know. Absolutely no way to know. So there's all kinds of worry now because one person decided she could stay behind and ride the storm out.
Well, hopefully she is okay. And the moment you said Wilmington, North Carolina, I was going to say, I wanted to bring up the whole storm because our dear friend Frank Giannini, Frank of the Bongos, and his wife Trish and the family are there in Wilmington, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And the last that I'd heard from them was, because I wanted to check in on them, was that they had generators, they had plenty of food, they'd been without power. This was the last Facebook message I'd gotten from them. They were without power. They've got plenty of food, plenty of water. The generators are working. And they will check in once the power comes back on. But the eye of the storm had, in fact, passed. At the same time, the first fatalities that we heard about that tree that fell on that house was, in fact, in Wilmington.
Right.
Which, of course, that brought up the whole thing about how can a parent be so unbelievably negligent to not take their child and go?
Right. With a week old. I'm sorry. How old was the child? Less than a couple of months.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is that you had how much time to prepare and go?
Right.
Calmly. It wasn't a state of panic. And you chose not to. And right. This is what happens.
Exactly.
There are a few other kind of more obtuse fatalities, like somebody who had a heart attack and somebody I think who was killed by trying to get his generator started. But I didn't hear of any others in that vicinity directly from the storm's results.
Right.
Nobody, in other words, no one was swept out and drowned.
Yeah. And the thing that I just do not understand, and in my cousin's case, doubly so, why? What are you staying behind to do? What is that?
It's not like you can walk the dog.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's no reason for it whatsoever that makes any sense. And I heard people this week talk about, well, you know, there's looters that come through after these storms. Yeah, there's not a thing in my house that's worth me living through a storm that could kill me for.
Right. It's stuff.
Right.
Stuff can be replaced. I'm sorry. That's just a way of life, you know?
Yep.
There are certain risks you have to take, you know? Your safety versus your stuff. You can't take it with you when you go.
Exactly. So, yeah, for her and for everybody else in Wilmington, I'm hoping for the best. But, you know, they were told over and over and over again, get out. We can't do anything for you if you stay. So if anything does happen, it's her bringing it on herself.
Well, the thing is, you know, it also reminded me of that horrible story here in Staten Island during Hurricane Sandy, when this woman took her kids at the height of the storm out trying to get away finally, and she was banging on neighbors' doors and no one was opening the door. Yeah, because there's a hurricane happening.
Right, they were all gone.
Right, and if they don't know you, are they really going to open the door and say, come on in?
Right.
That was just the lunacy. And of course, a certain element of our society, you know, chose to make it a political thing, and they were saying, oh, it's racism, and it's no, it's not. It's called common sense. If I don't know you, I'm not opening the damn door to you. And she had plenty of time and ample opportunity to up and leave.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's that simple. And people always want to do this kind of thing after, you know, they just want to make it, they want to make it so they can put the light on themselves. And that's what I want to lead to the next thing. And that was, we had the predominantly Democratic primaries here in New York on Thursday. And I'm very happy to say that, even though I'm not quite fond of him right now, Andrew Cuomo, our governor, won 64% of the nomination to that useless piece of shit actress, Cynthia Nixon.
Right.
No.
Yeah, and she was one of, what, four other challengers to him? And still, yeah, between all of them, they weren't able to split 35% of the vote.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. Well, they had this fellow named, I forgot, Jumanji or Jumanji Harrison or something like that, running as the opponent for lieutenant governor, which I find a strange thing that governor and lieutenant governor run independent of each other.
Same thing here in Missouri.
And the woman who is indeed the lieutenant governor overtook him in the end as well. Him I wouldn't want to see win because he's an out-and-out communist. You know, he's one of those democratic socialists.
Uh-huh.
If you're a Bernie Sanders disciple, forget it.
Oh, and speaking of which, and now that asshole's talking about running again in 2020? Good. Well, another 4 years of Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, let's get ready and make America great again. Years. Because this is what the Democrats want, because that way they can blame everything on Trump.
Right.
They want Bernie Sanders to go in there and screw everything up. You know it. I know it. We've talked about it ad infinitum unto death, you know, and nobody's listened. You know, nobody's listened. Everybody wants to ballyhoo. And a lot of people, you know, while I appreciate them decrying and villainizing Sanders and his ilk, like Jill Stein and everybody in that boat, they're still not doing anything to put a stop to him from trying to ride the coattails of the Democratic Party again. Make it very clear. If you're not a member of this party, you are not running on the Democratic ticket.
Yep.
The door isn't open. This isn't a welcome to the table kind of scenario. But, you know, there was, again, we had in this primary, a need for a new attorney general because of the scandals that befell Eric Schneiderman. And I'm happy to say that the woman who is our current public advocate for the city of New York, Letitia James, won that handily. I thought at first biggest opponent was this fellow named Sean Patrick Maloney. Thankfully, he didn't even get 25% because he's another one of these, you know, ultra lefty knob shiners who just loves to, you know, tout his whole, you know, oh, we're all one. No, we're not all one. And cut the shit already. Stop. Stop the socialist bullshit already. You're all a bunch of fucking communists.
Sean Patrick Maloney. Is that French?
You're thinking of baloney.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it is just a pork compost rolled into a meat package. But that other goofball, that woman, Zephyr Teachout, I
Oh,
always laugh when I hear
God.
that name. So fake. She came in second place for Attorney General. So everybody I wanted to have win in this particular primary won, and that's that. And come the election in a couple of weeks, fine. Whatever happens then happens. But at least none of these Bolsheviks will be riding on the ticket. Do we give a shit at this point about Alexandra Cortez Ocasio, or whatever the fuck her name is? Not really. Again, a minor character from a tiny district.
Right.
Everybody's jumping up and down, you know, with, oh, it's so exciting. And then they heard her speak, and they read the things that she said. And now they're all realizing she's a complete and utter moron, never mind that she's a liar.
Yeah.
So I don't really think, even if she wins her district, it means that much of anything. And it's a 2-year spot. She's not going to make any impact.
Yeah. Exactly. And like you
Period.
said, she'll be gone in a couple of years and she'll be a distant memory. But you know, the other thing that's going on politically nationally, well, there's a bunch, but with all eyes on the Kavanaugh hearings over these last couple of days, that has turned entirely now to being a referendum on whether or not he tried to sexually assault a girl in the 1980s when they were both teenagers. Now, that's not to discount it. If he did it, that's scuzzy behavior and he's an asshole anyway. But this, to me, is a it's such a sideshow. It's such a complete distraction because I was having some conversations with my mom while she was here, and she actually has had some dealings with Brett Kavanaugh over the years, because those are the circles she runs in, and she can't stand him. And she can't stand him because of his attitudes and because of his opinions on things and because of his political viewpoints and all of the things that should matter when it comes to a Supreme Court nominee. And what is it turning into now? Well, we couldn't get anything done as far as the real stuff goes. So let's, at the very 11th hour, trot out these allegations from somebody, and we don't know her from anybody. We've never heard of her before, and this is apparently the only allegation of that kind of wrongdoing that has ever happened against this guy when he was in high school, and so was she. What?
Add to that the whole thing about, you know, how many women signed this document saying that he never
63,
did
yeah.
it, right? And of course, all of the left, and I mean everyone, and I'm making this a blanket statement. Everyone and people I know who, of course, have to be the armchair quarterbacks for this, all pipe up with the same thing. Well, if he wasn't guilty of it, he wouldn't need to have all these women signing this document. Was it Dianne Feinstein or Nancy Pelosi who had something that was allegedly an irrefutable thing that she could have used against him to make sure that he did not get
This
this?
was it. Yeah, and it was Dianne Feinstein. Yeah.
Okay. And she waited till now, you know, even though she said she wasn't going to use it.
Right.
It sounds to me like the same kind of, and hear me out on this, and you know where I'm coming from with this because you know me, but it seems like the sounds like the exact kind of witch hunt thing that the Republicans always do to the left, and the left still managed to get away with.
Right. Right. And in
All
this
of
case,
this.
it's going to be no different because he's going to be confirmed.
Yeah, so I mean, just get ready for it, and that's all there is to it. Now, is it back to that old trope of Roe v. Wade? I really don't know, because you've had people who are so outrageously conservative. You would have thought it would have been turned over years and years and years ago, and it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
I don't think it's going to. I
No.
really don't.
No,
So.
and the states have found ways of being as restrictive. I mean, you look at the abortion laws in Texas right now, it might as well be outlawed. So does it really matter at the federal level whether Roe is still in place? Well, go to Texas and try and get an abortion, and then you tell me.
Well, keep in mind, though, Texas is also now removing Helen Keller from its curriculum, as well as Hillary Clinton, and there's one more. I just can't remember, but I mean, how do you rewrite history?
Right. But the thing is, you know, back to Kavanaugh, this is the problem. I mean, this is the whole thing being splayed out and the fallacies on the left and on the right, and the fact that, you know, if arguments are brought up about this guy and about how he can't answer any questions and about how none of his opinions make any sense and none of them jibe with current law and all of the verbal gymnastics that he's going through where he has no problem saying that a bunch of things are settled law, but when it comes to abortion, it's just precedent. Well, why the difference, asshole? And the problem is that you have so many gutless turds on the right who are sitting there going, so, do you like making airplane models? In a confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court justice, and they're not asking him anything meaningful, and they're not paying attention to the fact that there are meaningful reasons why this guy should not be in shouting distance of the Supreme Court. So what's left? Well, the only thing that they can possibly do is try to dig through his past and find some shit to bring up to throw at him and sling mud at him.
The thing is, though, at the end of the day, he's obviously not qualified. I mean, I did have my questions about Gorsuch.
Right.
And they certainly got him through, you know.
But he was replacing Scalia. So, you know, you're replacing A with B, and it doesn't make any difference at all.
Right. But in this case, now, this is somebody who's clearly not qualified to even be like a local judge.
Right.
You know, he's just... I'll leave it at that, you know. It's for itself because it is, once again, just another dog and pony show. And it really doesn't matter, who's wearing the black hats and who's wearing the white hats in this case.
Right.
You know, that's all irrelevant. But speaking of the back and forth, Nike and New Balance.
And is Nike winning the shit out of this war?
The thing is, though, and you and I pointed it out so many years ago, just after he managed to blow the Super Bowl, Colin Kaepernick is not that much – he's not an important football player.
Right.
He's an important figure, and he's an asshole of a human being. He's not this great, virtuous individual. Colin Kaepernick only cares about one thing, Colin Kaepernick.
Right.
You know, if he's so, you know, bent out of shape in making sure that everybody takes a knee – but yet he's doing this ad campaign for Nike. Let's talk about all the little Chinese kids sewing the shoes that he's going to be, you know, having people buy for $70, $80, $100, $200 a throw.
Right. Right. Not only that, you know, the part about him only caring about himself, I'm sort of fine with that. I mean, if that's who you are, and chances are if you're a professional athlete or a politician or somebody in that ilk, that's all you're going to care about because that's all anybody's told you to care about since you were a little kid. So that part of it doesn't bother me so much. What bothers me is if you're going to, and you kind of hit on it, if you're going to take part in a protest like that, and I think there are a lot of reasons why, if you strip away who he is and what he is, and you just take the thing that he's protesting, there is a legitimate gripe there. And whether or not it's a legitimate way to go about protesting it, it doesn't make any difference. That's what protest is. It's supposed to make people uncomfortable so that they notice you. But where he loses me is exactly what you just said. If you're the only Martian on the block that is taking part in that protest, why would you give a shit if anybody else does it? You shouldn't. It shouldn't matter. If everybody else joins you, great. And if everybody doesn't, so what? If you feel that you're in the right, then you feel you're in the right and you're doing the right thing. It doesn't make any difference whether or not anybody does it with you.
I was thinking back on the Tim Tebow thing.
Right.
Because people used to give Tebow shit because he's simply a religious guy.
Exactly.
And they did it in a really mean-spirited and vindictive way and to mock him because he's a Christian.
Right, and I couldn't care less.
I mean, I never found him to be – I find him to be refreshing because he seems like a genuinely nice guy.
Right, and he was also a lousy quarterback, so there's a comparison there as well.
Right, and he's a much better baseball player than he was a football player, which is surprising.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, you know, he took a lot of heat simply because he's a Christian.
Right.
He didn't try and push any kind of agenda or I'm protesting anything. He was doing something out of, dare I say, his spiritual nature.
Yep.
Have we fallen that far afoul of basic human decency that if somebody's a Christian, we have to mock them? I mean, I'm not a Christian. You're not a Christian. But yet I don't see us mocking them.
Right.
You know?
Hey, if that's who he is, that's who he is. If that's what he feels like he should be doing, then that's what he should be doing.
But let's see. Tebow is a target for scorn and mockery, while Kaepernick is held up to this, you know, moral high ground by the virtue signalers of America, because that's what it is. It's virtue signaling bullshit. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I have one pair of Nikes. I've had them for 8 years. They're in my gym bag. I only wear them to the gym. They're workout shoes, and that's what they're there for. It's a functionary purpose. It's not for any kind of political statement, you know, because I don't like Nike as a general rule of thumb. As a matter of fact, if I wear those kinds of sneakers, I tend to wear New Balance because they're the most comfortable. Since Adidas stopped making the kind of, as they always, I always refer, you know, the cross trainers that you could wear anywhere. I used to buy Adidas, and now I wear New Balance cross trainers because they're the most comfortable for my feet.
Right.
You know, it just so happens New Balance apparently has been anointed the sneakers of white supremacists because they're, well, you know, because they're made in America, except they're not made in America.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, so the whole thing is crocked.
Exactly. It's all about selling more sneakers.
Exactly. And that, again, going back to the Nike thing, people say, well, they support Colin Kaepernick. No, they support selling more Nikes. And they thought, okay, we can use this guy in an ad campaign. He'll come cheap because he's not in the NFL anymore. And we can, you know, we can start a big controversy. They don't care what side of the controversy you're on. All they want is what they've gotten over the last 2 weeks, which is to get 1,000 mentions more for free of Nike, of that name, over and over and over again than they would have gotten without him.
There's also something else. Remember this, and you know this well. People burn their fingers buying more Ruggles albums to burn.
Yes, album sales skyrocketed. People were buying them just to burn them.
And so people are burning their Nikes and then realizing, shit, I don't have another pair of sneakers.
Right. Yeah.
And are they going out buying New Balance? Probably not. They're probably buying another pair of Nikes.
Yeah.
They're just doing it on the hush hush.
Exactly. So yeah, it's all for show and it's all nothing. I mean, it's like people, it's the same idiots who smashed their own Keurig machines that they had already bought. Nike doesn't care. Neither did Keurig.
What happened with the Keurig machines? I missed something.
Oh yeah, it was about a year ago and it was the same shit. I don't even remember what the issue was, but they did something with their advertising that the right didn't like. And so you had a bunch of morons on YouTube smashing their Keurigs.
Terrific. Well, let's talk about other topics that are much along these lines. Let's talk about last week's first week of football. We briefly touched on this week's not so good results in football. The football season is underway. The Jets were impressive as all hell on Monday Night Football. I had a sinking feeling, to be honest with you, after Darnold on the first play of the season turned the ball over, and then all of a sudden he just led them to a romp, and I mean a romp, over the Lions.
Yeah.
Did not see that coming. They just made mincemeat out of them. Today they looked a bit clumsier and less organized against the Dolphins, who they've traditionally been toe-to-toe with.
Right.
I'm not sure if it was nerves at playing the first home game with all this overhype. I mean, it was only one game, but you know how it is in sports. Overhype, oh, it's the, you know, finally we've got the quarterback we need. Hang on. It's only his second game in the NFL.
Yep.
And it's his first home game. Now, in the end, they lost. I think it was 20-12 was the final score. But there were a couple of turnovers that hurt them this week, one of which being that they made the interception on the Dolphins only to blow it in the end zone. So that was bad news. But, okay, you know what? On to week number three. At least this week, the Bills put up points.
Yeah, they put up points. And, you know, in that first game, I mean, losing 47-3, it was just, it was a game that nobody showed up for. And we knew last year when Nathan Peterman threw 5 interceptions in the first half of the first game he ever played, everybody knew that he was a crap quarterback and that, you know, there was nothing there. And how he made it through training camp is a complete mystery. So he came out in the first game and now, granted, Buffalo's main problem right now is the lack of any cohesion on the offensive line. They're terrible. And you know, he was getting his lunch eaten. He didn't have any time to throw, but he's also a bad quarterback. And in that situation, you end up with Vinny Testaverde's first 6 years as a Buck. So that's what Peterman did. And we ended up losing the game 47-3. They pulled Peterman in the third quarter and put in the kid, Josh Allen. And he showed a couple of flashes, but again, the game was already well out of reach by that point. So fast forward to this week, and a couple of interesting things happened. First, you had a similar start to the game, where by halftime it was 28-6 San Diego, or Los Angeles, sorry, 28-6 Chargers. And, you know, it just looked exactly the same. The offense couldn't get anything going. And all of a sudden, in the beginning of the third quarter, Buffalo marched the field, scored a touchdown, and all of a sudden, the defense started to wake up a little bit as well. And the final score in the game was 31-20, which means that the Bills scored 14 points in the second half and only gave up a field goal. So you got the feeling that there was some kind of turnaround there. But the other interesting thing that happened, and it's not looking like Buffalo's going to be, you know, be anything good this year at all, unless they can start signing a bunch of really stud offensive linemen. However, at halftime, for the first time in the history of the NFL, the cornerback for the Bills, Vontae Davis, a 10-year pro, quit, retired, put on street clothes, and walked out of the stadium, and then released a statement saying, "I can't do it anymore. I don't feel like I should be out there, so I left." I've never heard of such a thing going on in major sports ever. And yet now, you know, the Bills are looking for another cornerback to replace Vontae Davis. And what a strange thing. I mean, not even to finish out the game, to just walk away at halftime.
Listen, hats off to him. If you know, you know.
Yeah.
And why prolong it? You know, why prolong it with a whole, you know, bells and whistles or farewell tour or any of that stuff, which a lot of athletes do nowadays. And you know what? I tip my hat to him for saying, you know what? I just don't have it. The hell with it.
Yeah.
It's not that important. My life is more important. Now, that leads us to the next thing, which, of course, I am greatly saddened by. And it took me a good couple of hours to digest. This past Wednesday, it was, when there was a press conference of the Mets. David Wright was reinstated into the team's lineup and then announced that he is retiring after he plays his one and only game this season on September 29th. And that's the end of a career that was marred and cut incredibly short by injuries that have led to, unfortunately, a degenerative back disease that he has, to which he's now the father of two young girls. You know, he's a husband, and he's got a life to live. He's only 35 years old.
Yeah.
That his career wasn't longer, that he didn't play physically on the field more with the Mets. This is one that you're always going to go, if only. Because when he was at his best, he was at his best. You know, a seven-time All-Star third baseman. You know, he's got records in the Mets books. And the most important thing and the most painful thing is that he is one of those of that ilk, that very rare ilk, especially in the modern world. He's a real throwback kind of player. He's a born and raised Met. He's from Norfolk, Virginia, so he grew up as a Mets fan because, of course, the Tidewater Tides for so many years, especially when he was a kid and growing up, was the Mets farm team.
Right.
He was signed by the Mets and grew up and went through that system and played his entire career with the Mets. And he was such a positive force, a leader, a class act, a good guy. Every positive thing that you could say about a ball player, the way a ball player is supposed to be, the way you envision, you know, the kind of ball player you want your kids to, if they're going to have sports heroes, that's the kind of role model you want. As loath as I am to use the words role model. But, you know, it's sad because the one thing that he deserved was a ring. And they never got. You know, they blew the World Series in 2015. They blew getting to the World Series in 2006. And those are the two times that, you know, he was on the cusp of being there for the whole thing. But it's going to be bittersweet because it's his final game. And it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that as the season ends, so will Jose Reyes' career. I think he's going to hang it up as well. So they came in together and they're going to go out together. So it's very fitting, but it's just painful for me because he was somebody that we had 12 years with, you know?
Yeah.
And he was somebody that was completely embraced by New York. Even Yankee fans have had a lot of class in saying, nope, David Wright's one of the good ones. And it's true. He really is. So, I tip my hat to him. As far as I'm concerned, I thank him for everything he's done and meant to the New York Mets. As a fan, he's given us nothing but joy. And I just wish him a long and healthy and happy life. And thank you, you know. So we say farewell to David Wright. We also say farewell to one of everyone's favorite actors, because we didn't get to talk about it. Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
The bandit is finally gone. The bandit has finally hung his hat. And remember, he never took his hat off for anything, so.
That's right. Well, and the thing is, I mean, how many great movies? And yeah, there were a lot of lousy movies in there as well, but they were never not fun. And that was the great thing about a Burt Reynolds movie is that I talked to Paul Williams a while ago about making those Smokey and the Bandit movies, and he said those movies were a joy to make and a chore to watch. And it's a great line, but still, I never failed to have fun watching even movies like Stroker Ace, which was just terrible, and Best Little Whorehouse, which was charming but terrible, and still they were so much fun. But the great thing about it, and what I think didn't get enough play in the news of his death and the aftermath, were those fantastic action movies that he made between like 1978 and 1985, movies like Sharky's Machine and Stick. And they were the first time since Deliverance that you really saw Burt Reynolds challenge himself as an actor and get away from just being the charming guy who would pull out the laugh and and wink at the screen, where he actually had to do something. And those movies, again, they weren't great movies, but that wasn't his fault. And it was interesting to see him do something to stretch out a little bit.
All I have to say about that is, why don't you clean this crap up off the beach? Keep the change.
Yes, indeed. And by the way, another movie that you will not really hear anything about that you
Hooper?
should. No, yeah, oh, Hooper's great,
Love Hooper.
but no, there was a movie that he just made with Ariel Winter from Modern Family called The Last Movie Star. And again, it's not a big movie by any means. It's not a great movie, but I think it's a nice homage. And for anybody who hasn't seen it, I think it's streaming on Netflix right now. Go check it out. I think you'll like it.
I'm surprised that none of the revival TV networks have brought Dan August back on the air.
Yeah.
Probably going to happen sooner than later. It
Right.
has to.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not shocking. He was certainly, how old was he? 83?
82, yeah.
82. I mean, so that's a good long life, an incredible career, an incredible body of work. He was hilarious. I mean, I never got the feeling that he took himself seriously. You know, which may have been his own grievance that he didn't, like you said, didn't challenge himself, because you just watch those movies and there's such an easiness about them. It's such a, they're a good time, you know,
Right.
which is why I love Hooper. That movie basically wrote itself.
Yeah, nothing
You
like the
know?
life of a Hollywood stuntman. And one of the guys that was in that movie, I don't know that he appeared in it on screen as anything other than a stuntman, but Dick Durock, who was Swamp Thing, in the movie with Adrian Barbeau, that movie was largely based on his autobiography, and it's really funny, and he's an interesting character as well.
Interesting. I always thought it was about Hal Needham.
Yeah, Hal was in there, and there was another guy. In fact, the local connection to that, for those of us here in St. Louis, there's a car dealership that was it's the Dave Mungenast family of car dealerships, and Dave Mungenast was in Hooper because he spent some time as a stuntman in Hollywood for a while, and he was the cop in the scene where the cop pulls Hooper over in the Firebird, and they end up hooking him, unbeknownst to the cop, they hook his belt to a line, and it's wrapped around a telephone pole. So as the motorcycle cop goes off to chase them, he ends up getting pulled backwards off the bike. That's Dave Mungenast.
That's such an American Graffiti device.
I
I'm
know.
sorry. That's Dreyfus getting his Pharaoh's jacket. I'm sorry.
Yes, yes.
My favorite line, though, because that's one, and I use it to this day. You know, with from Hooper was, you know, oh, it's his birthday. How what'll we give him? How about VD?
Yeah, right. And the fight scene with Terry Bradshaw where he spits out the tooth, it's
Yep.
just great.
It, you know, and of course. That incredibly hysterical, that the last gag that they do, you know, where they're going through that whole gauntlet of buildings collapsing, things blowing up, and then that jump off the bridge, really entertaining. It, you know, Yeah, I was a teenager at that time, but it was fun stuff.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that, you know, he also, in a lot of ways, the comedy team that they were building with him and Dom DeLuise was just perfect. I mean, the two of them worked so well together, and they did another one of the sort of unsung comedy movies that that Burt Reynolds did. It was a movie called The End,
Yeah, of
where he's
course.
facing his own death, and there are some scenes in that movie that are just solid gold. And the line from that one that I remember was when the first, I think it's the first time he tries to kill himself in that movie. He swallows a bunch of pills and tries to wash them down with bleach and then throws up all over the table. And he says, "All these colors, looks like Walt Disney threw up." It's just fantastic.
Another one of the greats gone, but
Yeah.
hey, it's all part of the circle of life, as it were. Now, speaking of greats, though, but go ahead, you were going to say
Yeah,
something.
I was probably going to lead into exactly where you're about to lead into, speaking of greats, because we have to appreciate the ones we still have around us.
Right, and this one in particular, who just seems to be popping up everywhere, literally, kind of like a venereal disease, actually.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, I really didn't need to hear about him and his songwriting partner in a circle jerk when they were teenagers. So obviously, you know who we're talking about. My hero, Paul McCartney, did a pop-up show at Grand Central Station here in New York last week, which apparently was just really wonderful to see. And, you know, of course, it's a spectacular event. He also did this little bit because you know how McCartney loves to be comedic and funny. And I hate Jimmy Fallon because he's pandering and watery. But they did this thing where, you know, people on an elevator, the elevator would stop at the wrong floor, the doors would open, and there'd be McCartney doing something. Like he's sitting and reading the newspaper, and he just smiles and waves, and the doors close on the elevator. Or the next time people come down, he's playing ping pong with Fallon. And it just, you know, McCartney is still just a really easygoing, great guy. That he's the greatest, most popular musician on the planet. Okay.
Yep.
You know, that's okay. But the fact that he still does this to reach out to fans, because I don't think it's about the money, and I don't even think it's about ego gratification. I think he just likes to do it for the sake of being out there with the fans. I mean, I think we've all seen at this point the full episode of him on Carpool Karaoke with James Corden.
Yep.
James Corden, who I really don't like. It's nothing personal. I just find him to be too cloying for his own good, too much of a sycophant. But with McCartney, it worked because he wasn't sycophantic. It was just a really natural kind of flowing conversation, I think, because McCartney puts you at ease,
Yeah,
you know?
and I also think they had more time to sort of flesh that out, and they could get rid of some of the cloying fanboy behavior that he's given to and just get on to the important stuff.
Right. And the thing is, you know, them going around Liverpool and McCartney, like, just sneaking up behind fans who are already taking pictures at the Beatles statue, and he's standing there in a pose of himself right above himself. He's like, no one's ever going to believe this, you know? Or when he goes and he signs the Strawberry Fields sign, or stops at the house that he grew up in, or at the barbershop on Penny Lane. Or, of course, when they do the thing in the pub where James Corden goes behind the bar and he's serving drinks and the girl wants to put on the jukebox and he gives him, like, oh, put on A21. And she puts on what's supposed to be Hard Day's Night, and all of a sudden you hear it start and the curtain drops and it's McCartney with the band. That made it all the more worthwhile. But there it is. McCartney does this pop-up show on the heels of the release of the new album, Egypt Station. Now, I've heard some of the tracks. They're okay. I've truthfully not paid much attention to McCartney's solo career since Tug of War.
Yeah.
Now that's 1982. That's already 36 years. You know, he's had a couple of good songs in that period of time. Press to Play was a good song. I actually like Spies Like Us. I think that's kind of a neat little ditty. This one was possibly the last truly great thing he did.
This one is gliding above the ocean. A god is riding upon his back. I'll calm the water and break the rainbow. Faith is one to blind.
After that, just didn't really pay attention to much of anything that he did. The songs are okay, but the problem that I have overall is the same problem that I have with him playing live right now, and that is his voice is just not there anymore.
Yeah.
And I look. He's what, 76 years old?
Yeah,
You're not
43,
gonna,
yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to sing like that at 76. Try as you might. And I, you know, look, I commend him for it. I'm not going to castigate the guy for doing this out of the sheer love of doing it. But it doesn't give me much pleasure to listen to, you know. When you are reaching a point where it's painful to listen to you, you should probably stop. You know, he still knows how to write a hook. He still knows how to construct a song. That's not to say that the songs aren't good. It's just that perhaps if somebody else was singing, it would probably be better.
Yeah, and it's not like it would be the first time in his career he wrote something for somebody else to sing.
Right. So having said that, you know, hey, we've got McCartney out there. He's going back out on tour. And right now, as we speak on tour, I'm happy to report, a healthy Michael Nesmith is making the rounds throughout the country with the first national band, Redo. And they're going to be here in New York this week. I unfortunately won't be able to go see them. But if you haven't seen Michael Nesmith perform, this is something special.
Yeah.
Because those shows are... they're very intimate, they're very powerful, they're very rich musically, and he delivers not just songs but stories. And what he has is the gift of what is definitely a lost, if not still dying, art. So by all means, go out and see Mike Nesmith. Please, I implore you.
I got lucky because on that front, with McCartney out and with Michael Nesmith out and with Peter Holsapple, who we'll talk about his music again in just a little bit, with him out on tour again, we got some bad news from one of my favorites over these last couple of days. And I just saw him for the first time within the last 6 months, and I'm really glad that I did, because Peter Case, ex of the Plimsolls, just announced this week that he was set to kick off his latest tour in Nashville, Tennessee, and had to cancel the entire thing for health reasons. He's had health problems before. In fact, he's had some pretty severe health problems before, but this time it was enough to cancel the tour. Now, he said in the statement, "We'll get everything back together and we'll be back out again next year." But fingers crossed. I mean, who knows? At this point, again, when you're talking about somebody who is into his 70s, all you can do is hope.
Is Peter that old already?
Yeah. Yeah. Believe it or not, because, yeah, he left, boy, he left Buffalo in the early 70s. And, yeah, so I'd have to check and make sure. But, yeah, I'm pretty sure if he's not 70, he's rapidly approaching it.
Wow. Just wow. Well, here's hoping that that he gets well soon.
Yep.
And that's all that matters is that, you know, his health.
Believe it or not, 64. You were right. He is a little younger than I thought.
Let's talk about Mr. Holsapple, because it is wonderful to see him out there playing sporadic gigs with the Peter Holsapple Combo, which features Will Rigby of the DBs on drums. You now have a copy of Game Day. What do you think about
it? I love it. I love the direction of it. You know what? I love the vibe of it. It's music that feels good to listen to.
Yep. You put it in a lot less, put a more economic spin on it than me being verbose about it and trying to paint a picture of each song. But the thing is, it sounds great. It's got that garagey crispness about it.
I knew a band. Knew a man for men, and they slept on floors and drove a Chevy van, and they got pretty good and made it all they could. But then the singer slipped and it all went south.
Basically, for somebody who's been doing it as long as he had, he sounds rejuvenated and young again.
Right. And that's the thing that, you know, the original point of the sort of what became known as the lo-fi movement was exactly that. It was to capture an energy and a sound that just fit the music. And now it's become a thing that people spend a whole lot of money and a whole lot of time on computers in the studio to try to recreate. I have the feeling Peter didn't do that. I have the feeling Peter did it right and just went lo-fi with the production.
Yeah, I mean, it was him playing the drums on a lot of the tracks. Right. It's like, okay, I'll put the mics here, and, you know,
let's, and here we go, rock and roll.
And that's all you can ask for. The fact is, those songs, the man can write a song like nobody's business. He is one of our greatest living musical treasures.
Yep.
I have said this before, I'll say it again. Look, his partner in crime, Chris Stamey, another incredible gifted composer. But the thing that always drew me more to Holzapfel's work versus Stamey's, and I love them both equally, is just the fact that Chris Stamey is a composer. He thinks about these. They're very, very esoteric, and there's a lot of deep thought and theory going into the structuring of his songs. They're meticulous, which is what makes them so spectacular on that end, because he does it in a pop framework.
Yep.
But with Peter Holzapfel, it's from the gut. And, you know, the way he frames it, it's speaking a language that I completely understand. There's a purity there and a directness that I've always connected with. You know, especially when you hear from the very first time, you know, when you're all of, what, 16 years old and you hear that opening build-up riff to the, I don't want to say snotty, but snide vocals of Bad Reputation.
Yeah.
You know, you connect immediately. You can't not connect immediately. And that's what I love about Holzapfel's work. And that's why I love Game Day, because in its own way, it's a return to form. You know, the one thing that I found a little uneven about the last DB's album, Falling Off of the Sky in 2012, is that both he and Chris Stamey delivered very lush material, save for the opening track, That Time Is Gone. That was more in the, quote, DB spirit, you know? The music that they delivered for that album was a lot more, yeah, it's mature and it's not as, you know, bouncy poppy as you'd want from the DBs, but yet here on Game Day, a lot of this would feed into that whole DB's mindset. Now, I'm comparing one to the other in just the sense that he's doing it for himself now. This is the Peter Holzapfel combo. These are not songs for the DBs, nor do I think the DBs, if they were to be playing out live, would be doing these songs.
Right.
But the fact is, I think he's just been completely rejuvenated, that he's doing it again. And look, I don't know if you've seen the pictures, but now he's got himself that white gilt Thunderbird, you know, the kind that Zalianowski played in The Lovin' Spoonful.
Yep.
Hey, he got one finally. He's ready to go. They're going out there. They're playing dates coming up very shortly with the Pylon reenactment. I think it's the Pylon Reenactment Appreciation Society is the name of the band. And I think it's a terrific combination, and I've heard nothing but great reports about them. So
good.
You know, this is, yes, somebody that we love who's out there doing their thing.
Yeah, and doing it right. And yeah, so another great release, by the way, from our friends at Omnivore. So a tip of the hat to them as well.
Oh, absolutely, because they just, I'm happy to say they haven't missed yet. So,
right.
So I've got one more thing that I want to bring up, and that is, have you heard of this anonymous New York Times op-ed piece?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, and there are a couple of more musical things we want to get to as well. But yeah, the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times with this, whoever it was, and now Donald Trump is falling all over himself trying to figure out who it was that's torpedoing him from the inside, saying that, yes, indeed, there are still adults in the room and that there's this force working against Donald Trump's more base instincts to try to keep disaster from happening because of the president of the United States. And this isn't some disgruntled ex-employee. This is somebody working for him currently.
Now, I know I'm probably spitting in the wind here, but people have said it was probably Trump himself who did this.
I don't think so.
I don't think he's smart enough to. I don't think he has enough patience to really sit down, conceive of, and execute such a thing. I don't see it.
No.
That's my cynicism coming through, to be honest with you.
Yeah, no, I agree. He's too dumb. And, you know, no matter who wrote it, there are a couple of things about this that have been kicked around. And even in the first campaign stop that he made after this, Barack Obama made mention of this. And he said, you know, this isn't the way government is supposed to work. There shouldn't be these forces working against the will of the president, blah, blah, blah. But there are a few things that I think have been blown way out of proportion about that editorial. First of all, even the op-ed piece said, we're not always successful in stopping Trump from doing what Trump is going to do. So whatever resistance this is supposed to be inside the White House is meager at best. And the other thing about it is that's what an advisor is supposed to do. And the writer of the op-ed never says, we're doing this in some kind of illegal fashion, you know, that we're subverting the president from the inside. What he says is we're working to keep him from letting himself get away from himself and screwing things up to the point where it can't be fixed. And it never mentions the methods. It could be as simple as talking him out of shit, which isn't difficult to do. So if he says, which one in the Woodward book they actually make mention of, let's assassinate, what's his name in Syria? Let's just, you know, we'll send a crew of Navy SEALs over there and they'll assassinate him. Well, you can't do that. And if somebody sits him down, so, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or whoever sits him down and says, you know what, I understand you're the commander in chief of the armed forces, but that's internationally illegal shit and you can't do that. And they talk him out of it. That's doing exactly what that op-ed writer said he was doing. Nobody said they were doing anything illegal.
What's your take on the op-ed piece? Because frankly, I just thought it was more bullshit from the New York Times. If you want my honest opinion, because I just think that they've already done so much damage to everything at this point, and I feel that their journalistic merits and value are almost nil.
No, I think it's authentic.
Okay,
I do, and I have my suspicions about who wrote it, because you have to remember for the last year, my initial inclination was that it was Kelly, and I still think it may be, but the other suggestion that makes a lot of sense is Jeff Sessions, because Trump has been kicking him in the teeth for a year, and the last bit was, again, a quote from the Woodward book where Trump is calling him a dumb Southerner and a stupid redneck and making fun of his accent and all that shit. And I can see Sessions sitting there writing that entire thing out and hitting send as he's going, really? Dumb Southerner, huh, asshole? Boom. Send. So maybe.
But is he that articulate?
Yeah. You know, he's not, as much as I hate him, he's not that dumb.
So he just plays it being, a mealy-mouthed weasel.
Right. And he is a weasel. And that's the other thing, is that this whole idea that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, that is the most dangerous bullshit that anybody could ever fall victim to. And if it is Jeff Sessions, he's still a hateful little weasel. And you can't forget that. That's why it's been funny to me to watch all of the Democrats going, when is Jeff Sessions going to grow a spine? And, you know, it's good that we've got somebody like Jeff Sessions in there. These are the same people who screeched when he was nominated for attorney general in the first place. He's still that guy they hated. They have to remember that. He's not a good guy just because he's giving shit to Donald Trump now.
Oh, what a tangled web we leave.
Yes. So you don't think it's authentic, though? You think the Times just made this shit up?
I just think there's something not right with it. It just didn't sit well with me when I read it. That's all.
Yeah.
I'm unfortunately so ingrained with, you know, doubt mixed with contempt and skepticism for anything the Times says or does right now.
Yeah. Well, what it smells like to me is somebody inside the administration who knows that it's all about to come to a crashing halt. They know, first of all, they know they're going to get the shit beaten out of them in the midterms. And they're loathing that. And they understand that there is every possibility that Mueller will come out with enough indictable shit that they're going to have to take seriously impeachment proceedings. And so what it looks like to me is somebody inside that cadre wants to cover his own ass and say, well, I was the guy. So when it all falls apart, they can say, I was the guy who was in there telling you guys I was trying to work against him. See, I told you he was a crook. It's a nice cover your ass move.
Yeah, except those usually don't work. They backfire.
Right. Well, I didn't say it was going to work. I just said that's what's going on.
Fair point.
But yeah, before we leave music entirely, though, there are a couple of things that you put up on Music Tap this week that I want to hit on real quick, because one of them I have not yet had the chance to review myself, but you wrote about Bird Streets. What's Bird Streets?
Bird Streets is actually the nom de plume, as it were, or nom du disque in this case, of a fellow named John Brodeur, along with Jason Faulkner.
Okay.
And it's this incredible, frankly, piece of power pop genius. And I mean genius. It sounds great, first of all. Our old buddy Luther Russell is part of this. You know, he's playing along on it. Just to give you a quick glimpse at it, the name actually comes from a real estate enclave in the Hollywood Hills.
Okay.
Where they did the recording of this record, but also somewhere in Albany, where John Baudoir is originally from. So the thing is, what I like so much about this album is it immediately catapulted me back into the early 70s radio. You know, when you listen to AM radio and you hear things like the Raspberries.
Okay.
You know, that kind of driving rock kind of feel, you know? But it's not strictly of that ilk. It's not that style specifically. Yeah, there's a lot of definitive 70s rock pop type of tracks on here, but there's also things like, I'm going to guess, a Rickenbacker.
Yeah.
Because there's really birdsy couple of numbers in there. There's also some very intense early REM style pieces. It's great stuff. It's great arrangements. If there is any justice in this world, as I always want to say, and there was such a thing as the importance of radio, these songs would be blasting out of your radio while driving. That's how I gauge the quality of something nowadays. If I feel or hear it as something that you could interpret as classic,
yeah,
then that would be this. It's a really, really good album. It's tight. It's fully realized. 11 songs that keep you interested. It keeps you gripped, and you want more. And when I want more of something after I've already gone through it on the first pass, you know that there's something special about it.
Yeah. That's cool. And the other one that immediately grabbed me, because I love the name, first of all, and then scrolled down the page and started listening to the song that you posted up from them, is a group called The Artisanals. And this I think of as really something special, because whenever I hear somebody, and we do this a lot, we make comparisons back to, you know, this sounds a little bit like that, and going from one band to another. The thing that grabbed me about this, and I've been telling people about this, is that the lead singer sounds so much like Bono. I mean, so much like Bono. And yet the music is completely un-U2. And I thought, you know what? This is great. And it's interesting. It's fun.
It sounds like $1 million.
Wow.
And this is their debut album.
Right.
I mean, they're a Charleston-based group. They're a new-ish band. They kind of consider themselves 70s-styled heartland rock.
And okay.
Kind of tongue in cheek, because I wouldn't consider Tom Petty really 70s
right.
or hand rock, and just like I wouldn't consider Springsteen. But the thing is, they're a fairly new band, and first of all, this album, as you noticed, has a lot of width to it.
Yep.
All the songs don't sound alike. There's some out and out pop. Then there's some kind of that early 80s sound that you and I love, you know, the Chameleons, the Sound, the ComSat Angels, that delay / chorus / echo.
Right.
You know, they get that sound really, really in there.
I could be a one trick pony with nothing left.
So much guitars, and yet there's one track called First Time, which is just guitar and piano, you know? You know, they know how to slow it down and quiet it down and go less is more. And then there are times when they just plain old poppy.
Right. And just build it up and come back with it. Yeah, I love it. So definitely want to check out musictap.com and read a little bit more about the artisanals and check out some of the music as well. I hope that they see it through long enough to see more of what they've got in the tank.
That makes two of us. The only thing that's the one thing that causes me a lot of fear these days is that when a band puts out a spectacular debut and then they just call it quits afterwards.
Right.
It's always very deflating.
Right. Or they hit that sophomore jinx and you just go, what happened to you guys? Where are you? So yeah, keep it up, artisanals. And yeah, just keep writing. And that's the best advice you can give anybody, I guess, especially in that realm, is just keep at it and keep writing stuff and keep recording as much as possible. So we'll watch out for new stuff from them. And as we get to In Our Heads this week, you know, I don't know that we've done this much and spotlighted a band, but something occurred to me because this goes back to Mom coming into town, and I'm always looking for things that when we're riding around in the car a lot, that I can just put on and not think about much. And I know Mom, like my dad did as well, is a big fan of the Rolling Stones. So I just put the Rolling Stones on and let Alexa pick the music and just let it go. And what occurred to me was, as big a fan as I am of the Hot Rocks album, which the compilation from 64 to 71, when it picked out those songs that were just after that, in the Graham Parsons era, and you know, when the music changed pretty dramatically and leading into things like Emotional Rescue in the late 70s and early 80s, that it was so many dramatic shifts. It was like listening to four or five different bands, even though it was always coming back to the Glimmer Twins. And I wonder with you, from each one of their sort of iterations over the years, what the favorite songs are.
19th Nervous Breakdown. No, The Last Time is still my favorite.
Okay. All
right. The Last Time has always been my favorite by the Stones. Then followed very closely by 19th Nervous Breakdown, Lady Jane.
Yep.
Probably their version of You Better Move On. Which I've always loved because we used to do it.
Yeah.
Well, I used to do it as part of our acoustic set. I'll tell you what, most of the Aftermath album, because it's a terrific album, whichever version you have, the British or the American one, you know, there's a song called Think, which I think is absolutely terrific off that album. Complicated off of Beggar's Banquet. Between the Buttons is a great song. You know, to be honest with you, I've gotten tired of all the hit singles, quote unquote. I could go the rest of my life without ever hearing Satisfaction again.
Right.
I do like Jack Flash because it's just good old meat and potatoes, no frills, no bullshit, you know, getting back out of the psychedelic bag thing. Having said that, I actually do like things like Dandelion, 2,000 Light Years from Home. I like some of the tracks off of Satanic Majesty's Request.
Yeah, and the one that I can't get away from that era is one of the hits, although it seems to have sort of fallen out of favor with rock radio for whatever reason, because it's not one of their top three of all time, is Street Fighting Man. That song comes out, I just reach for the volume knob and crank it as hard as it'll go.
It's just that I'm sick to death of Satisfaction. I don't really like Get Off My Cloud. I think that's kind of dopey.
Yep.
I like Mother's Little Helper a lot. I like a lot of the singles. I also like a lot of the early stuff. Like, you know, I like their version of Not Fade Away. I liked Timing. I think that's a really good song. I really like their version of Round and Around, the Chuck Berry song, which kicks off the album 12x5. I loved, and I mean loved, their versions of Mercy Mercy and Hitchhike. You know, I thought that was the Stones at their down home best. You know, that's still early, you know, Stones as a cover band primarily, you know. But, you know, songs like I'm Free or Blue Turns to Gray or The Singer, Not the Song, those are great songs. Yeah, but my favorite is still The Last Time. That was the most perfect attempt at utilized pop.
So when you move that forward into that period from like 1972 to 1978, is there anything there that really rings your bell, or are they just kind of moving?
No, very little. And I'm very. It's kind of known that once Brian Jones was gone, I really didn't have that much flavor for the Stones.
Yeah.
I think absolutely nothing, frankly, of Exile on Main Street. I never got the hoopla about it. I actually think Emotional Rescue is one of their better late period songs. I think it's hilarious. Even it always makes me laugh.
Right, and that's the thing, is the people who can't stand that song totally miss the point.
It cracked me up from the moment I heard it because it's just so over the top and dopey.
Yes. You know? Right. It was supposed to be. And that's the major knock on it, is that, oh, it's so completely overdone. Right. Exactly. It's so completely overdone.
She's So Cold is a great song.
Yeah.
What else from that period? Cause there are several of them. You know, I do like Little TNA. I kind of like Waiting on a Friend, even though it's been played to death.
Right.
You know, Tattoo You is possibly the last great thing they did, as far as I'm concerned. Although, oddly enough, I thought Mixed Emotions was a good song, too. Mm-hmm. And that's 89. It's catchy, you know? But most Stones 70s material never really did anything. Starfucker makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Obviously. But, you know, it's only rock and roll, you know, Angie, all that stuff. Just, you know,
Right. And again, I think it was a matter of just overdoing it, because that's all we heard. And when you have a song like Dead Flowers to lean on, you know, and you don't, then there's a problem there, because that song, to me, I mean, that whole image of you and your rich friends can kiss my ass. I like that, because even though there's a certain mythology to that, the same way there was a certain mythology to Street Fighting Man, it doesn't matter. It was the character he built for himself, and it just fit.
You know, my whole thing is also that period of the Stones on their own label at that time. It was once the Rolling Stones Records era began.
Right.
Just seeing too much of the exact same thing, too much of the exact same style of Charlie Watts playing those drum patterns. It became like, it's hard to really put it into the right terminology, but I think you'll get where I'm coming from. It just became a formula that they ran and ran right into the ground immediately, probably starting with Honky Tonk Women.
Yeah. Right. Right, and it was a lot about where they were and where they were recording that sort of infiltrated the music. And I don't know, you're right. I think it just got to be a rut. It got to be too much of a rut too fast.
Yeah, I mean, the Mick Taylor era means nothing to me, frankly. You know, I don't care for any of those records. And, you know, yeah, Ron Wood was a nice addition, but I really would have always rather have seen him playing with either Rod Stewart or with Jeff Beck.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with any of that stuff. All right. Well, we will do some more, and of course, keep watching Music Tap and keep watching Popdose for more interesting material elsewhere on the page. And leave us comments. Let us know what you're thinking about what we're talking about here on the show. And Rob Ross, I know it will be another good week, and we'll get our health and our heads back into the game and in full, and we'll watch what goes on in the NFL and what happens as hockey season starts up and baseball season winds towards its eventual close next week.
This is true, but you know what? I think I'm going to take the page right from what you just said, and yeah, it's going to be a good week. Think positive thoughts, and let's just keep our little motorboat going along on a nice even tide, rather than having to deal with ripples and waves that might capsize the boat because of ill health or whatever. So, on that note, my brother, again, a happy birthday, and have a great week. Feel well, and I will talk to you later.
You got it, man. Take care. More to come next week on Radio City, and enjoy yourselves.